This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Ramat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. And this week, Fuad, you're talking about Friedrich Nietzsche and his idea of how to live life as an artist or as art.
Yes, well, that's not his phrase, but I just rephrased it for this episode since I wanted something that sounded catchy. But essentially,
Are you
something
pandering to the masses, Fuad?
Yeah, just for the purposes of summarizing Nietzsche for half an hour show, I think that's a bit necessary. Nonetheless, I do think that people can relate to this because this is where I think Nietzsche is most profound and very interesting. You know, he's often appreciated as a critique of religion, but people often overlook or don't emphasize enough what he proposes as a solution, and that is to see life as a work of art. And we hinted about this in one of the earlier episodes, but we didn't get a chance to really unpack it, so I figure why not do that today.
Now, for those of us who don't know Friedrich Nietzsche very well, perhaps we could say a little bit about him before we begin on this journey. Mm-hmm. He's from the 19th century, mm-hmm. and he's German, mm-hmm. and his father was a conservative Lutheran of some mm-hmm. sort.
And he even went through training at a seminary.
Okay, and that really shaped him in a profound sense,
it
right?
Did. Yep.
And we've done an episode on his position on God and mm-hmm. his famous phrase that that off-quoted, perhaps less understood phrase, God is dead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The question, of course, there was, you know, who killed God?
Mm-hmm.
What is the question that Nietzsche is asking for which art is the solution?
Essentially, it's, how do we live? How do we celebrate life? And this is in response to a kind of complacency or even pessimism that he felt was rather pervasive in
The applause is thunderous applause for Nietzsche right there.
Yeah, I know. People are really excited about this. But no, it's a response to a kind of pessimism he was observing and a kind of complacency in how people are relating to life. And this he felt, looking at life as a work of art would unshackle us from sort of the common ways in which we think about life. One of it is, of course, when we undergo difficulties or when we encounter hardships and tragic moments in life. And that often drains us from really seeing existence as a fertile ground for joy, you know, rather than misery. And he is responding to this, essentially this impulse that he felt that was very dominant among people.
Now, you know, let's kind of stepping back and say, well, okay, if one doesn't approach life as an artist might or live a life as if it was a work of art,
mm-hmm.
you're thinking of other types of labor because the making of art is a particular form of labor, right?
So yeah, Nietzsche doesn't look at it that way, though. But yeah, we can just, for the purpose of discussion.
Yeah,
we can,
because, you know, you think, okay, how else would you approach life? You could approach like as an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
With that kind of framework, you know, there's a balance sheet, mm-hmm, you know, there's mm-hmm. you put in your entries, costs and benefit analysis.
Very religious too. It parallels a lot with religion as well when we think about virtue and sin, right? We're always kind of keeping track of how we're doing. And that's something that Nietzsche felt was very corrupting.
Then, of course, there's ways of looking at life as an engineer might,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you think of kind of constructing and forward planning and mm-hmm. all those things that, you know, so people are very attuned to putting things in place, you know, retirement plans and mm-hmm. You don't live life for the moment. You mm-hmm. you know, you don't live life as some religious, philosophies might have you, you know, dependent on providence. You know, you leave it up to God to decide, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So you live from day to day, in hope that God will provide something for you in that next day. You're not here to mm-hmm. plan it all for the next 60 years until retirement, including, you know, mm-hmm. your funeral expenses.
But he's against that planning too. As we go along in our discussion, we'll find that he's aiming for a certain type of energy from within us, a kind of burst of life that he feels is completely curtailed by, never mind just the fact that life can be disappointing and we succumb to that fact, or B, the notion of shame, the idea that we live by rules and standards that are arbitrary. We feel that we are straitjacketed by these rules, that we can never be ourselves. And see, we never have the space or sometimes the courage to really defy those things. So we live life suppressed in that way, suppressed from our truest personalities, desires, so on and so forth. So that's a one kind of a superficial level. But he was also aiming something deeper, and that's the kind of he felt ascetic piety that he saw as a manifestation of a withdrawal from life, where you view pleasure with suspicion, you view suffering as instrumental to getting through life, and you see this, all this, as just a momentary stage for a longer eternity. Or he even took aim at metaphysics, because he felt that philosophy, the act of contemplating an ideal world where we look at a priori categories and a truth that transcends everything, as another mark of how life has beaten us down to the point that we look for meaning in a different world or in a different realm of thought, so on and so forth. So all those things come together as his object of critique.
Now, the we in your statements are very interesting, because they actually, in some sense, refer to Nietzsche's world, mm-hmm. Nietzsche's society, European, Protestant, and perhaps of a period where people were all the things that he is attacking. Mm-hmm. Whereas for the rest of the world, that description might not hold. There are many societies, globally, perhaps not the ones that are dominant now, for whom, very different conceptions of life exist. And, pleasure is something to that, they might have embraced on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And they structure their lives with a balance between the labor and, their cultural pursuits, their social pursuits, their, the sense of making community might have been as strong as the idea of accumulating wealth that was predominant in Nietzsche's European society. So the critique really applies to us who have come to mimic Europe and its values of that time to some extent.
Yes, this is a very good point. Nietzsche often talks about Europe and Germans in particular. And Germany is a different... German modernity was a kind of a different creature than French or English modernity, which were often assumed to be more radical or more dynamic. Germany... things were moving a little differently. And for Nietzsche, what he saw was, that complacency in culture, where there was this kind of malaise in how they were going about thinking about the world and so on and so forth. And so you're right that he, too, had in mind only a particular kind of context. But I think, while it doesn't apply to every possible world there may be, I think that insofar as there is... in us, whoever's listening to this, some kind of metaphysical impulse, that is to search for a true self, truth beyond everything else, a kind of justice that is viewed as transcendent, or this kind of recourse to religion to save us from the horrors of everyday existence, then I think they might resonate with what Nietzsche has to say about life as art.
And also, I think, there's culture that's come along with global capitalism, mm-hmm. that's taught us to discipline our bodies in particular ways, think our pleasure purely as something that we purchase through commodities, mm-hmm. That we're taught that there's virtue in deferring pleasure, and so on and so forth. So there are values that have become, in fact, global, mm-hmm. as a consequence of capitalism and its way of ordering life.
That's a great point. In fact, one of the things that Nietzsche criticized was to see pleasure as escape. So we only embrace pleasure in a repressed state, where it's a kind of venting, it's a kind of exhaling rather than a real crafting, which is what he tries to aim for here. So,
okay, yeah. What text are we looking at and are these lessons, in fact, scattered through his writings?
They are scattered through his writings. In fact, I'm taking quite a leap here, going out on a limb, trying to synthesize all of his lessons in a very short discussion here, because while he does have a track that talks about art very specifically as a birth tragedy. He reviews his position much later, you know. So
so you said the birth of tragedy, yeah. So that is...
That's his earliest work, in fact, yeah. So he talks about Greek tragedy, and from there he really crafts this idea of art as existence. But he's going to refine it much later. And perhaps we don't have to get into too much into the nuances because it'll get very scholastic. But I'll try my best to synthesize the consistent themes throughout. So
from the birth of tragedy, could you, you know, give us a sample of the kinds of things that he was concerned about?
Yeah. So in this passage I'm going to read is, again, that metaphysical impulse that sees the world as fundamentally inscrutable and complex, and from there a kind of search for true knowledge, search for true wisdom departs. And he feels this is very life-denying. So this is one passage where he talks about it. It is an eternal phenomenon. The insatiable will always find a way to detain its creatures in life and compel them to live on by means of an illusion spread over things. One is chained by the Socratic love of knowledge and the delusion of being able thereby to heal the eternal wound of existence. Another is ensnared by art's seductive veil of beauty fluttering before his eyes. Still another by the metaphysical comfort that beneath the world of phenomena eternal life flows on indestructibly. To say nothing of the more vulgar and almost more powerful illusions which the will always has at hand. And here he's talking about how that impulse, again, to look for truth and beauty somewhere else, you know, and to see, and here art becomes a victim of our escapism. And that's something that he wants to warn us against. And this is another passage, also from The Birth of Tragedy. You ought to learn the art of this worldly comfort first. You ought to learn to laugh, my young friends, if you are hell-bent on remaining pessimists. Then perhaps, as laughers, you may someday dispatch all metaphysical comforts to the devil, metaphysics in front. Right? So he wants us to seek that comfort of this existence. And this existence, not just as a kind of long phase in our life or anything, but everything, even in the smallest things we often take for granted, you know, because again, in this life-denying impulse, he points to the tendency to seek recourse in somewhere else and a kind of escape from the present.
Now, in the second passage you read, he actually is addressing people. He says, my young friends. What is the nature of that text? I mean, is it a letter he's writing to people, or a speech? Is it a dramatic moment?
It's actually a history book. It traces the emergence of tragedy in Greek culture. And he finds this interesting because he saw tragedy as, you know, to put it simply, a way of liberating yourself from the sorrows of the world.
So why is there this my young friends phrase in the text?
Oh, well, he's an aside. He's writing, you know, he's like, to my audience.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I see. Yeah. That was the conventions of the time. Was it?
It's a stylistic flourish, yeah. He's not on a podium speaking. But there's an important point here, and that is, in The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche is talking about how tragedy as a form of art emerged in Greek culture, and he found it very interesting because he saw it as a response to the tendency to deny life among the Greeks. And that's one. The second thing he found interesting was that Greek culture was alien from his own, in that there was no Judeo-Christian imprints, there was no notion of history that is constantly progressing. It wasn't a liberal democracy that promised happiness to everybody in an elusive way, so on and so forth. It was a different culture, yet one which saw the tendency of life denying, but managed to resist it through the catharsis of Greek tragedy. And so that's what makes The Birth Tragedy a unique book. This is not a discussion about that because it's very complex, because he's going to get into Greek. But I think that's a very interesting impulse to show where Nietzsche was going with his considerations of art. Yep.
So we're going to come back with more on Nietzsche and his ideas about how to live life as if it was a work of art.
Yes.
You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahman, myself, Sharad Kutin. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues with Ahmad Fuad Rahman and Friedrich Nietzsche. No, he's not in the room. He's just...
I wish.
Yes. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Quite a coup. I don't know if MCMC would let that, but yeah.
I think we'd need a crystal ball or somebody, you know, to make a connection between this world and that other world. And though he was not for that other world.
No. He thought it was very, very corrupting, yeah.
So let's leave Nietzsche dead and celebrate the work that he left in many, many books. You know, in part one, you talked about the birth of tragedy, but as you also noted, Fuad, you said that his ideas about art are sprinkled throughout his works, and you know, and so we can turn to other texts as well to have a sense of what Nietzsche was concerned about. Mm-hmm. What other texts are there?
Well, plenty. He talked about art everywhere, pretty much. Twilight of the Idols, Will to Power, The Gay Science. So it's because he proposed, you know, this artistic existence as a solution to life denial, which he saw in metaphysics and religion. It was something that he needed to maintain throughout his critiques, so that he's proposing actually something in place of that, of the objects of his criticisms.
Okay, Fuad. So what, simply put, what does Nietzsche mean by art?
Art is such an elastic term, you know, people define it very differently. But what Nietzsche had in mind was not cognitive or representational art. It was not art that claimed to show a different reality or claimed to show idealized forms. It wasn't art in certain products such as sculpture or painting. He wasn't really looking for that. He didn't want to limit the notion of art to merely its form. What he was going for was a kind of energy, a kind of a way of life, a way of looking at life that he felt would really unleash newer potential in human beings.
And is that in no way connected to artistic forms? Are there no connections? Is he just sort of distilling some philosophical point from the idea of pursuing beauty?
No, there can be forms. It's just that you cannot define them as those forms. So it's the way he's concerned with style, and he talks about the grand style, which we'll talk about soon. It's not the art is not in the product, but in the way in which the artist expresses life, which could be perhaps could seen in these products, but it need not be defined by this product. He even talks about nature as being very artistic, because there's this kind of life and this kind, all these things that happen in nature, very mysterious, very sporadic, and this he felt was very reflective of a kind of raw truth, a raw attitude to the world that human beings can perhaps learn from. He talks even about how everybody is in a way already an artist. You know, he talks about how dreams are a kind of art. You know, it reflects a kind of artistic impulse that we have. Even religion, for all of his criticisms against it, is a reflection of our artistic capacity. You know, in the iconography, in the poetry, in the kind, in the beauty in certain scriptural parts, or the narratives, the myths, so on and so forth. This shows a creative potential. So he is pointing to something that's already there in us. And that is artistic, because it is out of that orientation we have towards life that all these other forms of art emerged, right? So that's what he wants to salvage.
And what is the goal of all this?
What he wants to point to is this capacity for transfiguration, or a kind of metamorphosis. And that we can read as a kind of revolutionary change in how we relate to life, right? And this change is particularly physiological. Right? He wants a relationship with the world that incorporates our personality in its fullness, right? A lot of times art can be very, like I said, cognitive, very cerebral, very visual, or very conceptual, that it is only our mind that is drawn into a piece of work, or our soul when it comes to religion, or, you know, a certain moment in the evening when we walk into the theater and then we kind of renounce it when we leave, you know, or something that we confine to in the weekends or something like that. That's not what he's going for, because his emphasis is a certain orientation towards existence. He wants us to embody that capacity for art, for aesthetic expression as a way of life. And that's what he means by a transfiguration.
What is the word transfiguration? Is there any particular reason why that word would be used, or is German equivalent, as opposed to all the other words that you could use? Is it
you know, is this your Catholic subconscious?
I think that's transubstantiation. I think is the reference to the Holy Communion, right? When in fact the wafer turns into the blood and body of Christ. But that's transubstantiation.
That's transubstantiation. But Transfiguration is a famous painting by Raphael, where I think my biblical knowledge is very very limited here, but it is Jesus at a radiant state. I mean, that's what the painting looks like. I don't know what the story is, but he draws it from there directly. And again, he's playing here with this transformation that he's calling for, you know, because he feels that however much you think you're beyond a kind of everyday mode of being, that our real potential is somewhat suppressed for as long as you don't really grasp this notion of life as a form of art.
In the Birth of Tragedy, he's looking at Greek tragedy. It's, you know, it's one of the main cultural forms that came out of Greek society in the classical period. But then now you're saying he's also made a reference to a work by a painter, Raphael. And so is he looking around and actually looking at art? Do they become inspirations for the kinds of thoughts he has about the human condition?
Yes, but he does not idealize any one artist. Maybe Wagner at first, but there's a long discussion on his relationship with Wagner as well. But eventually, he became a very strong critic of Richard Wagner.
So that is the composer, Wagner.
The composer, correct,
right.
Correct.
Okay, so there's music, there's theater, there's painting. All of them are grist for this mill of his philosophical mill, trying to understand how best to live life.
Correct, and what that shows a key style that he feels is lacking, in that oftentimes art is seen to be very compartmentalized. But he wants to kind of weave all the energy from all these different expressions into lessons by which one can learn how to be more expressive in the artistic way he wants. So this is one passage where he talks about this transfiguration very briefly, but he definitely hints at the kind of state that we should be in when we embrace life to its fullest. If there is to be art, if there is to be any aesthetic doing and seeing, one physiological condition is indispensable: frenzy. Frenzy must first have enhanced the excitability of the whole machine, or else there is no art. Right? So,
wow, that's from Twilight of the Idols.
Twilight of the Idols, yeah.
Why frenzy? Is there a particular... Okay, I'm going to like...
Sure.
Go on about this, but is there a reason frenzy is the word?
Yes, because that is a very... Frenzy is the opposite of the Platonic state of cognition, right? Where... And this is religious too, again. When, you know, just think of how when we moralize about human rights, right? We talk about how it's inalienable, how it's self-evident. And without we realizing it, the source of our reference to human rights is somewhere else. It's this kind of idealized, transcendent set of values. You know, it really escapes the kind of horrors that we see in this world. Or there's the idea that we have a true self somewhere else and we hold on dearly to it at the face of all the judgment and shame we might face in everyday life. Or the religious impulse, where we're really doing good first and foremost to seek salvation in a different world. There's this kind of flight from the world that breeds a kind of seriousness, a kind of certain asceticism towards life. And frenzy, this drunkard state, this state where you really have no shame. You're not thinking of what people might say. You're not thinking of what another person's gaze might be judging. Is a form of freedom and a presence in the here and now that he feels is truer to what we can aspire to than all those other transcendent kind of recourses. You know, even this is another passage which I think is kind of relevant to this, is where he talks about the Dionysian artist, right? Who is also, he associates the Dionysian artist with music, as opposed to sculpture or painting, which calls for a kind of more cognitive kind of reflection. Dionysian art is one where you dance, you're with your body, you know, and you let go in that moment to be with the present, where what goes on in your head, your worries and your preoccupations is less in power, right? So this is what he says.
But before that, just to clarify, Dionysius is a god, a Greek god.
Sorry, yeah, a Greek god,
right?
Correct.
And associated with
the god of wine.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, so Dionysius, was a god, was a Greek god, the god of wine, and this is Nietzsche's, I think I would say a kind of homage to him in this paragraph, is from the Gay Signs. The being richest in overflowing vitality, the Dionysian god and man, may not only allow himself the spectacle of the horrible and questionable, but even the fearful deed itself, and all the luxury of destruction, disorganization, and negation. With him, evil, senselessness, and ugliness seem, as it were, licensed in consequence of the overflowing plenitude of procreative, fructifying power, which can convert every desert into a luxuriant orchard. So again, you know, he's calling for this attitude where, you know, come what may, you're not calculating the consequences each time, which is what life kind of beats us down to do. You're not measuring every action based on values that are ultimately abstract. And in that, you're realizing your potential, you're realizing the joys you could have, you're realizing your capacity to feel more and more. And it is in that chaos, right, that frenzy, that you are really being in touch with an artistic expression.
Now, is it a question of different religious frameworks that underpin different societies and cultures that make these things possible? And does Nietzsche have a particularly nostalgic or rose-tinted view of Greek society and its religion? I mean, is he celebrating it as such, or is he saying, is he just drawing lessons from it for the people of his time?
I would say he celebrates it. He does a bit of both. So he celebrates it. And you know, this is something that a lot of scholars of his time was doing. There was this rediscovery of Greek philosophy after the medieval period, because when the medieval period, Christianity had absorbed a lot of Greek metaphysics, that people felt that their understanding of Greek philosophy was very brushed with Christian concern. So there was this, in German high academia at that time, this movement to rediscover the Greeks, and he was a part of them. Marx was a part of them as well. Hegel was. You know, Schelling. And so there was this return to the Greeks that he was a part of, yeah. So it was an awe towards this culture, which was so rich in intellectual experimentation and artistic expression, so on and so forth, but also to draw lessons for his time.
Yeah. I guess there were intellectuals, European intellectuals at the time, who also looked elsewhere to other cultures.
Correct.
Especially those in the East, which they saw something that is not reflected in their own culture, and were, you know, drawn to explore those.
Yeah, Goethe wrote the West Eastern Divan, right, which is a homage to Hafiz. As we're discussing this, Shara, I do wonder, you are an artist yourself, you're in theater. You know, what do you make of this? Is any of this resonating to you as a person in who is involved in the performative arts?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it does seem to be at a remove from the kinds of things that somebody who's a practitioner is thinking, you know, primarily about, in the sense that it's not a manual to make art. It's about saying, you know, what is it that the good life is, and how should we, you know, comport ourselves or place ourselves in a way that makes us more likely to have a rich life. The idea of consuming art, of course, is very big today, and it's for the middle classes. It's really become part of the many things that you can purchase. So consuming art today doesn't necessarily mean taking on some of the deeper attitudes towards life that art might actually encourage, mm-hmm. or, you know, that a deeper exploration of the artistic way might suggest about how to live your life. It's mm-hmm. just a commodity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate. If you're a practitioner and you're particularly sensitive, you might actually think about that. And so your labor then transforms you, right? Mm-hmm. But I think far too many people think of art these days as something to be purchased, and they often know about art because something is sold for millions of dollars, and, you know, in an art auction, and that now is the main image that art is a commodity.
And consequently, it removes us further and further from life. Actually, this is an interesting occasion to bring in a passage where Nietzsche launches into a critique of artists. This is where Nietzsche juxtaposes himself and with other artists, yeah. And it's from the Gay Signs. It says, one should learn from artists. What means have we for making things beautiful, attractive, and desirable when they are not so? And I suppose they are never so in themselves. We have here something to learn from physicians, when, for example, they dilute what is bitter or put wine and sugar into their mixing bowl. But we still have more to learn from artists, who in fact are continually concerned in devising such inventions and artifices, to withdraw from things until one no longer sees much of them, until one has even to see things into them, in order to see them at all, or to view them from the side, and as in a frame, or to place them so that they partly disguise themselves and only permit of perspective views, or to look at them through coloured glasses, or in the light of the sunset, or to furnish them with a surface or skin which is not fully transparent. We should learn all this from artists, and, moreover, be wiser than they. For this fine power of theirs usually ceases with them where art ceases and life begins. We, however, want to be the poets of our lives, and first of all, in the smallest and most commonplace matters.
So he recognizes the artist might not have that kind of critical distance from precisely the kind of labor that allows someone like him. He's viewing them from the outside and sees the essence of what they're doing. They're there too caught up in what they're doing to actually recognize its greater significance.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and I think at this point, I mean, we're taking a very un-Nietzschean route, and that we're abstracting a lot here. But you know, bringing it back to our just sort of everyday life, I think the lesson here is to, in many ways, free ourselves from the seriousness which is compelled by the gradual snowballing disappointments we accrue in life. You know, that really beats into us a kind of pessimism, a kind of fear of the world. Out of which we develop a greater sense of shame, a greater sense of meekness to everybody else, and in that it suppresses our potential for just being who we are and kind of cultivating a lightness of existence.
The other thing, of course, about these experiences of reversal and it is that in many ways it does prime people for all kinds of hateful ideologies, and in a political sense. And I think of one Malaysian filmmaker, Yasmin Ahmad, who in one of her films tries to draw a sense of where racism comes from in the Malaysian society. And she has this character who is not loved by a husband, who the husband is kind of seeing some other woman, you know.
Which movie is this, by the way?
This is, I think it's Sepet, but you know, Yasmin Ahmad's films kind of meld into one another. I know it's not Mualaf. I think it's either Sepet or Gubra or one of those. But so there was this character, and she starts to, but her racism is not kind of anti, so the character's Malay, but she's not anti non-Malays. What she is anti her Malay neighbours who are not Malay enough. So, but it's still a form of racism. It's a form of saying, well, you're not like me, and who I am is what we are, and you're somehow beyond that. Mm-hmm. But it comes from a place of neglect, of hurt. And so, you know, these injured animals, creatures we call human beings, then go off into the world and create all kinds of politics that, in fact, revisit us as this horrific, hateful ideologies that we have.
And that is a very important point, you know. Maybe we can discuss another time, you know, his genealogy of morals, where he talks about this, in many ways paralleling what you just observed. How these, you know, as we internalize a lot of these disappointments, they'll reach a point where a self-righteousness develops. And as this widens into a kind of mood in society, it can manifest into ideologies, into religions, into attitudes about others, you know, into a kind of bitterness and jealousy towards the happiness of others or the freedom of others. And but all of that stems from a kind of cynicism and skepticism of one's ability to really just live freely without the burdens of hurt and disappointment and so forth. So we are reshaping a world in the image of our bitterness. Yeah.
We're going to have to come back to that, the genealogy of morals, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because we've run out of time. Mm-hmm. And I'm really thankful that you brought this up, because I don't think often that Nietzsche is known for his kind of exploration of art, or at least in the kind of popular imagination of Nietzsche. He's often reduced to, and I think maybe the value of our discussions on Night School about Nietzsche is really to give him more depth and for people to see that he's a very rich thinker, and he's, you know, his thoughts kind of move in all kinds of directions.
Most of the time he's just reduced as this curmudgeon who has a grudge with religion. I mean, to a certain extent that is true, but he also has something else to offer. Yeah.
Okay, so we can continue those discussions on our Facebook page, and perhaps we'll just list the names of those texts that we have mentioned in this show.
Well, The Birth Tragedy was one. The Gay Science I read from quite a bit too, but it's kind of peppered everywhere, and all these texts are actually available online. You know, they're reproduced online for your viewing. But Birth Tragedy is a very fascinating book. It's actually not that difficult to read, although I warn you that he will revise a lot of his conclusions in his later works. But it's worth starting out with. Yeah.
Wonderful. So that's BFM Night School on Facebook or bfmnightschool@gmail.com. You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, who does not have a Twitter account. I do. I'm Sharad Kutin, @Sharad Kutin. And we'll have more on Night School next week. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.